within me and within my son. Jacob was excited to tell Michael and me all about his film program, the scripts he was writing, the short film he was making. It was easy to sit back and just watch him. He fit right into the candlelit Hollywood restaurant with its palm fronds and comfortable banquettes. 17, sandy-haired, lithe, with a Roman nose and deep blue eyes, he was a gorgeous boy, and I was, had always been, besotted with him. Maybe because we had come so close to losing him when he was small, I never took him or anything about his existence for granted. So many times I had wished my father and Jacob could have known each other. I conjured up the ease and friendship they might have had, both of them sensitive, kind, thoughtful, honest men. I was also comforted, I now realized with a start, by the thought that something of my father continued to live on in Jacob. Susie had no children. After me, Jacob was the last genetic link to my dad. I had always searched for my dad in his face and his mannerisms. If Jacob had children of his own someday, there would, in some small way, be a tiny bit of Paul Shapiro continuing on in the world. This felt, though I never could have articulated it, like something I had done right. Pru Uravu, be fruitful and multiply and fill the world. The first words God spoke to human beings in Genesis. They were apparently more important than the commandments not to steal or kill or lie. Pru Uravu, the first mitzvah. Had it given me pleasure to think of Jacob as my father's descendant because I knew how important that would have been to my father himself? Now, as I sat across the table from my son, I felt heartbroken. Not for him. Not for me. But for my dad. Beneath the palm fronds, as our waiter cleared desserts, I gave my phone a quick glance, always a reflexive habit, but more so these days than ever. I drew a sharp breath when I saw that Ben Walden had answered my last email. From Dr. Benjamin Walden to Danny Shapiro. Ray, important letter. Thanks for the information. I am forever amazed by the power of the internet. Your research may be correct. I may plan to have DNA testing to evaluate this. I'm very grateful that you will respect our privacy and are not interested in disrupting our family. First of all, congratulations on a very successful writing career. My wife and I plan to read your memoir. If the DNA findings show a match, I would imagine you would be interested in some family history, especially any medical history. If you let me know the questions you have, I'll try to respond. Chapter 23. Each time I felt strong and resolved enough, I typed various search terms into Google. Sperm donor, donor conceived, donor anonymity, ethics of donor anonymity, history of sperm donation. I ordered all sorts of books, which would be waiting for me back home, packages stacked on our front porch. I already had a pile of articles from the 1940s through the early 1960s about Dr. Edmund Farris. I could hardly bring myself to read them. The language was archaic and devastating, like something from a science fiction comic book. Test tube tots. Was that what I once was? There seemed to be communal outrage about donor insemination in the years surrounding my conception. Ethicists, religious scholars, lawyers, even many physicians believed it to be unlawful and immoral. At the same time, there was a smug certainty on the part of the doctors and scientists at the forefront of donor insemination. Secrecy, anonymity, and even eugenics were discussed in a matter-of-fact way. Donors were chosen for their perceived genetic superiority. Records, heavily coded, were sealed or destroyed. Parents were told to go home and forget it ever happened. But the language of contemporary reproductive medicine was no easier to contemplate. As I scrolled through websites and online essays, words swam, sentences broke apart. In every other area of my life, I was capable of clear thought. But here, I was back in the thick sludge. It became quickly apparent that the community of the donor conceived was robust and active. I stumbled upon words I hated. Apparently, Ben Walden was my bio dad. Paul Shapiro was my social dad. The phrases made me feel like a freak of science. But then I read that being donor conceived often made people feel like freaks of science. One website offered special jewelry, conceived just for you. Parent on a chain necklaces fashioned out of aluminum, chrome, or brass, on which hung dog tag shaped charms customized with donor numbers. I wanted to hold myself apart as if none of this really applied to me. The understanding that this world was my world, that I was donor conceived, that this was indeed and had always been a term that applied to me, rose up like a concrete wall I slammed into again and again. One name kept appearing on research papers, websites, even on Oprah: Wendy Kramer. She had created something called the Donor Sibling Registry, a resource for donor-conceived people who were out there desperately searching for their genetic relatives. I found myself wanting to reach out to Wendy Kramer. But why? I didn't need her services. I had already found my biological father. Ben Walden didn't occupy the deepest, most tender part of my attention. What I wanted: confirmation from someone, an expert, that it was possible. No, more than possible, likely. No, more than likely. Absolutely the case that my parents had known nothing. The Farris Institute had hoodwinked them, gone rogue. Someone must have decided it would be in this couple's best interest to add donor sperm to the mix without telling them. Maybe the Institute was trying to increase its success rates, or Dr. Edmund Farris had decided to play God. Our last couple of days in Los Angeles were taken up with work meetings, more visits with Jacob, as well as lunches, coffee dates, drinks dates, and dinners with friends in that sprawling city that was in many ways a second home to us. Sometimes I told the story, and sometimes I didn't. I had begun to learn that telling it didn't necessarily make me feel better. Increasingly, I found that as I recited the narrative, it became amorphous, the vastness of it like an echo chamber. I would feel my mouth move, hear the words as if someone else were speaking them. I grew quieter and quieter. I was dreading going home. I kept thinking of our house, with its walls covered with portraits of my ancestors, my writing office, where I had surrounded myself with them, my grandmother, grandfather, my father and Aunt Shirley as children. I pictured a bucket of paint and wanted to whitewash the entire interior, a blank slate. Finally, I wrote to Wendy Kramer. Each time I wrote a new person in this strange, unfamiliar world, I felt exposed and vulnerable. But I encountered nothing but kindness from those I contacted to ask for help. Kramer got back to me within minutes. We made a phone date to speak that afternoon. At the appointed time, I wandered Wilshire Boulevard, looking for a quiet place to talk. I stopped at a nail salon that had a small metal table with two chairs on the sidewalk out front, and asked the proprietors if they minded my sitting there. In the bright yellow-white light of the Los Angeles afternoon, I organized my materials as if I was reporting any old story: notebook, pen, noise-canceling earbuds in place. Just as I dialed Kramer, a woman came with her bagged lunch and plopped herself at the small table next to me. I stared at her as she unwrapped her sandwich. She did not meet my eye. "Fine," I thought. I had no time to find a more private perch. Kramer was warm, direct, and entirely unhurried. As I walked her through the details of my discovery, trying to ignore my table mate, I wondered how many times she had been on the receiving end of such calls. The donor sibling registry had close to 50,000 members. Anyone doing even a rudimentary online search would land on her website, where her contact information was listed. "You realize how unusual it is that you found your donor," she said, "and so quickly." I did understand. Kramer's entire website was devoted to those searching, often fruitlessly. I was dimly aware of my own gratitude. I had already been supplied with a massive piece of the puzzle, even if I never had any further contact with Ben Walden. I knew who he was. I had seen his face. I had heard his voice. I knew where I came from. "Do you ever hear stories like mine?" I asked her. "People in their 40s and 50s who never knew?" "All the time," Kramer responded. "And more and more. People are doing DNA testing just for kicks and getting the shock of their lives. There was such a culture of secrecy. Sometimes the mother tells after the father has died. Other times, there's a letter left in a safe deposit box." I watched the passing cars on Wilshire Boulevard. My table mate showed no sign of leaving. "But I'm sure my parents didn't know," I said to Kramer. "I think Ferris must have used a donor without my parents' knowledge." There was a brief pause on her end. "Why do you think that?" I had begun to explore the halacha, the body of Jewish law, as it pertained to the subject of donor insemination. It wasn't just forbidden. It was considered an abomination. The word nauseated me. Abomination. Did this mean that I was an abomination? According to Jewish law, the sperm donor would have paternity, not the infertile father. "Your father is still your father." "Not according to the rabbis." "My father was an observant Jew," I said to Kramer. "He would never have been okay with not knowing if a child of his was Jewish." That was what my mother had said, wasn't it? The sentence remained indelible, preserved for all these years. Later, Michael will point out to me that my mother had not in fact answered the question I had asked. She simply posed another question in response. And further, her choice of words was striking. "Wouldn't know the child was Jewish," as opposed to "wouldn't know the child was his." "Your parents had to know," Kramer said. My tablemate scraped her chair back and stood, slowly gathering her trash. "It's out of the question," I responded. I hunched over my notebook, scribbling, trying to get our conversation down so that I could attempt to understand it later. The very idea was unthinkable. I mean that literally. I was unable to entertain on any level the thought that my parents had known all our shared lives, that they had purposefully deceived me, withheld from me such an essential truth, that they had looked at me, their only child, with the awareness that I had not come from the two of them, but had been fathered by an anonymous medical student. There had to be another explanation, one in which a nefarious doctor had duped them. I clung to the only story I could tolerate. A few days earlier, a wise friend, the Buddhist teacher Sylvia Boorstein, had told me that my present state reminded her of a particular illustration in Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince. At first glance, the illustration appears to be of a big green hat, but on closer examination, it becomes clear that a boa constrictor has swallowed an elephant. I was that snake, choking on the elephant. "Well, your mother had to know," Kramer said. I wondered why she was so sure. She didn't strike me as the kind of person who would issue forceful opinions for no reason. I thought of my mother, her simmering fury, her ownership of me, her condescension toward my father. Was it possible? Could my mother have orchestrated my conception without my father's permission? "The mother always knew," Kramer went on. "I've spoken to thousands of donor-conceived people. I've heard thousands of stories. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I've never heard a story in which the mother didn't know." Chapter 24. Another memory, or perhaps less a memory than something vestigial, now pulled from the ruins of my childhood. Just as I can feel Mrs. Kushner's hand on my shoulder, just as I can see my mother's profile illuminated by the lights of the George Washington Bridge, so another moment comes to me whole. I am 3 years old, and my mother has brought me from our New Jersey home into New York City, where the well-known children's photographer Joseph Schneider is going to take my portrait. It isn't the first time I've been in front of Schneider's lens, though it is the first time I have any recollection of it. My mother knows him from back when she worked in advertising, before she married my father. His background as a child psychologist makes him uniquely suited to photographing young children. He is adept at eliciting certain moods and expressions from them, and if all else fails, he bribes them with candy. Snap. Schneider makes faces at me. He thinks I don't know that he's holding a button in his fist that is making the shutter snap. Snap. My mother must be close by, watching. I've just looked it up, and Schneider's studio was on West 57th Street. There may be faint city sounds from the busy street below, the sigh of buses, the wail of sirens, honking horns. Smile, Danny. Over here, Danny. Something tells me that this is important to my mother, that I had better perform and perform well. That's right, Danny. She would have pronounced my name as she always did, as if it were slightly foreign and exotic, drawing out the A. Danny. I have very few memories of my early life, but this, the shutter, the button in the photographer's fist, the sound of my mother calling my name, is one of them. Schneider wasn't just a portrait photographer. He had been responsible for discovering the babies who were in the commercials and ads for everything from Ivory Snow to Pampers. He recruited babies and children from everywhere. Agents, managers, proud mothers, even hospitals. I recently dug up a profile of him in a 1977 issue of People. "You're lucky if you get one good baby out of 15," he sighed to the reporter. "A kid is as individual as a thumbprint." The portrait from that day's shoot became the holiday poster, the Christmas poster, for Kodak that winter. In it, I am set against a pitch-black background and wearing a black pinafore over a puffy-sleeved white blouse. The pinafore is decorated with a deep red poppy. My hair is cut into Dutch boy bangs, and I am playing with a wooden train that carries a half-dozen red and green wooden elves. I appear solemn, quizzical, as I focus on a point just above the camera's lens. The way my mother always told the story, the Kodak people, clients of Schneider's, just happened to be visiting his studio shortly after he had taken my portrait and had asked if it might be possible to use my image on the poster for their national campaign. My parents agreed, and that winter, a massive Colorama billboard dominated the main terminal concourse of Grand Central Terminal. A poster hung on a wall at FAO Schwartz for years. Ads were spotted by family and friends all over America. As I recall, it was a source of great merriment in our home, the fact that an Orthodox child was out there wishing the entire nation a very Merry Christmas. Such a hilarious accident. My mother loved to tell it. She had brought me to the city for a commissioned portrait, and instead, the executives at Kodak had discovered me. A framed version of the poster had a place of pride in the living room of my childhood home, where anyone visiting would be sure to see it. Beneath my quizzical face is a whimsical illustration of a couple being pulled through a snow-covered field on a horse-drawn sleigh. Confirmation bias, a psychological term I had never heard before, but one with which I will become intimately familiar, is the process by which the mind seeks to confirm what it already believes. When in the throes of confirmation bias, we seek and interpret information that will allow us to continue to hold on to our beliefs, even when presented with contradictory evidence. "You aren't Jewish," Mark Strand had flatly said. "We could have used you in the ghetto," Mrs. Kushner ran her hand through my hair. "Raised kosher," I replied more times than I can count, went to a yeshiva, spoke fluent Hebrew, and when faced with the bemusement, the disbelief, "I know, it's crazy. I mean, I was the Kodak Christmas poster child." Once back home in Connecticut, one afternoon Michael stood for a long time staring at the Christmas poster, which now hangs in Jacob's bathroom. "This was shot as a Christmas ad," he finally said. "What do you mean?" "You're playing with red and green elves," Michael said. "Look at them." I stood next to him, examining the photograph of me that had been a part of my life's narrative for as long as I could remember. And for the first time, registered the truth of what I was seeing. It was unmistakable. The elves' red and green hats were shaped like Christmas trees. The colors of the portrait were Christmas colors, down to the black and red dress I wore. It was not a portrait commissioned by a Jewish mother from New Jersey. It was a portrait deliberately shot as a Christmas ad. "Are there any other pictures of you wearing that dress?" Michael asked. "No, no, there were not." Perhaps Joseph Schneider called my mother to suggest she bring me in to audition for the Kodak ad. Or it is also quite possible that my mother proffered me herself. She had disdain for stage mothers, so never could have admitted to such a thing. But given the opportunity, she could not have resisted the lure, the temptation of the spotlight. Her daughter, her hard-won daughter, her only child, so surprisingly pretty, so shockingly fair, beheld as the classic, iconic American child. As she returned home from the city, her mind must have worked overtime to fashion a series of lies my father would believe. My mother was quite convincing when she had her sights set on something she wanted badly. "Paul, you'll never believe what happened. The Kodak people want to put Danny on their holiday poster. Wouldn't that be so funny?" Her unsteady gaze, her wide, practiced smile, her self-consciousness, the way every word seemed rehearsed. His stooped shoulders, the downward turn of his mouth, the way he was never quite present. Her rage, his sorrow, her brittleness, his fragility, their screaming fights, the harsh exchange of whispers behind their closed bedroom door. As a child, not much older than I was when I played with the elves and the red and green train, I pressed my ear to that door. I strained to listen. "Your parents had to know," Wendy Kramer said. "Your mother had to know." My mother is buried in a cemetery near the Jersey Shore. My father's bones lie in the Shapiro family plot in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. And I am straining to listen now. Chapter 25. The hottest summer on record became my season of carefully crafted letters. I stayed indoors, in the coolest, darkest room in my house, drafting odd requests and entreaties. The first of these was to Haskell Lookstein, a well-respected New York City rabbi who had known my dad. I let him know in an email that I'd made a stunning discovery about my paternity and was hoping to speak with him about the halacha, an area he was uniquely suited to discuss with me. The week I wrote Rabbi Lookstein followed on the heels of his involvement in a controversy. He had been invited to deliver the benediction at the Republican National Convention, and his acceptance of the invitation had caused uproar among many members of his Upper East Side synagogue. Though he had changed his mind about offering the benediction, he was probably still dealing with the fallout. As I sent him an email, I wondered if he'd have the energy to meet with me. He was 84 years old. But I didn't have long to wait. I heard back from him that same day, inviting me to visit him in his office at the Ramaz School, the yeshiva founded by his father. The morning of my meeting with the rabbi, I scoured my closet for my most modest skirt. It was a sweltering day. My longest summer skirt hit me 2 inches above the knee. My shoulders had to be covered, too. I checked my reflection in my bedroom mirror, turning this way and that, beset by a feeling of not quite rightness. It was familiar, the sense of being inappropriate that came upon me whenever I entered observant society. The city sidewalks outside Rabbi Lookstein's office shimmered. 2 double-parked trucks had created a bottleneck on the corner of Lexington Avenue and 85th Street. I was early for my appointment and stood in the shade of an awning across from the entrance to Ramaz. Once again I was dizzy, lightheaded. I jumped at the sound of a jackhammer. I was nervous about meeting with Lookstein. He would have been a young rabbi at the time my parents were making their trips to Philadelphia. Was it possible that my father had consulted with him on the halacha? That the rabbi had direct knowledge about the circumstances of my conception? Or not? Maybe Lookstein knew nothing at all, because my father had known nothing at all. Part of my father's history resided within the ornate synagogue across the street. He would have attended services at Kehilath Jeshurun with his first wife, Susie's mother. I could picture them, a handsome couple, entering the arched doors in their Sabbath finest. Perhaps he would also have gone to services there with his second wife, Dorothy, before her illness took its final turn. It was only with my mother that my father left the fold, moved to New Jersey, so they could begin anew. It had always been true that in synagogues, when I heard the melodies and language of certain prayers and songs, I would hear my father's voice close to my ear, as if he hadn't been gone for decades. Adon Olam Asher Malach. I would sense his presence in these sanctuaries where he had felt most at home. I could hear him now, as I stood no more than 100 yards from the closed doors of Kehilath Jeshurun. I could feel the smooth, worn fabric of his tallis, the silky fringes I played with when I was very young. Beterem Kol Yetzir Nivra. How could it have been that I felt so close to my father, but not at home in his world? I was buzzed in by the security guard and slowly climbed the steps to Lookstein's office. The building was hushed, quiet. School wasn't in session. Seated in the receptionist's area, I leafed through copies of Eretz magazine. I pulled my phone from my bag and texted Michael. My longest skirt is the shortest skirt in the building. Rabbi Lookstein was a slight man with a trim white beard. He invited me into his cluttered, book-lined office. On the far wall, behind his desk, was a portrait of Joseph Soloveitchik, another beloved Orthodox rabbi who had been close to my family. Soloveitchik was considered by many to have been the greatest leader of modern Orthodoxy in the 20th century. On the floor, near the door, was a huge blow-up photo of Lookstein wearing a Mets jersey and cap, standing by the dugout at Citi Field. One of the team's owners was probably a congregant. He seated himself in a chair facing me. "I think I know why you're here," he began. He did? All I had told him was that an issue had arisen about my paternity. What could he have gleaned from that? I braced myself for whatever he was about to say. "Your mother had a first marriage before your father," he went on, "and you're worried that she never received a proper get." A get is a Jewish divorce. The rabbi had thought about this. What other issue could I possibly have been bringing to him? At that moment, I realized that Lookstein knew nothing. There was no memory, no ethical dilemma about whether to be honest about a long-ago conversation. I felt flooded with relief. How desperate I was to believe that my father had been in the dark right alongside me. No, I replied. It's a bit more complicated than that. I launched into the story I'd learned to tell without feeling the shock of its impact. I began with my DNA results. "I'm not even sure that Halacha recognizes DNA results," he interrupted. But as I proceeded, he grew quiet and listened carefully, his hands folded in his lap. When I finished, telling him only the salient details, leaving out my correspondence with Ben Walden, which seemed in that context like a betrayal of my father, he nodded and stroked his beard. "What concerns you most?" he finally asked. After managing to keep my feelings tamped down, suddenly I was crying. "Whether my father knew," I answered, "the halacha, it seems so unlikely that he would have gone through with it. Whether my mother deceived him or..." "You'll never know," the rabbi said. "You don't know who you're dealing with," I thought, but didn't say. "You'll never know" was unacceptable. "You'll never know" simply could not be what I was left with in the end. Who was I without my history? Lookstein gave me a long, searching look. "Which story would ease your heart?" he asked. "The true one," I answered. "No matter what, you're Jewish," he said. "Your mother was Jewish. Jewish egg, Jewish woman giving birth, the child would be Jewish. There would have been no need to convert you." None of this had occurred to me, nor would it have mattered. One of the more minor surprises thus far had been how little I seemed to care about my acceptability as a Jew. And your son is Jewish, no issue there. Jewish mother, Jewish son. He said this kindly, as if offering me relief. But do you have any sense of whether my father would have sought rabbinic advice, I asked, and what you or another rabbi would have told him? Lookstein had the sad brown eyes of a basset hound, set in an elegant elfin face. He crossed his legs, touched two fingers to his lips. His eyes traveled to the portrait of Joseph Soloveitchik behind his desk. Kol hakavod to your father, he suddenly said. All the honor. If, God forbid, I had been in that situation myself and my wife very badly wanted a child, I would have agreed to it. What are you saying? My stomach roiled. The room expanded and contracted like an accordion. Are you saying you think he knew? Yes, Lookstein said. But the halacha? I would give your father the credit that he wanted your mother to bear a child. He would have been fulfilling the mitzvah of Pru Urevu, the first thing God said to Abraham, be fruitful and multiply. I couldn't keep this version of the story in my head. My mother's logic now rendered moot. It couldn't be true. My father had been many things. He had been fearful, terribly anxious. At times he'd had a temper. He was prone to depression. But he was an honest man. Could an honest man keep the truth of his daughter's origins from her? So you're telling me that my father would have proceeded with total acceptance? What I'm telling you, Lookstein said, is that he would have felt he had done a huge mitzvah. I left Ramaz with the rabbi and we headed west to Park Avenue. His head was covered by a straw fedora, and he clasped his hands behind him as he walked. I was less steady on my feet than a man in his mid-80s. I didn't believe this story. I wasn't even sure Lookstein believed this story. I thought back to his first words to me. You'll never know. The bright sun beat down on us. Every few moments a passerby greeted him and he tipped his hat. Hello, Rabbi. Good afternoon, Rabbi. This square block was his fiefdom. Was he just trying to make me feel better? Was it his rabbinic judgment that easing my heart was all that mattered? This was a more difficult question than the one I thought you'd have, he said. If you send me your phone number, I wish to speak with a friend, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, who might have further thoughts on the halacha. As we rounded the corner of Park Avenue, Lookstein spoke fondly of my father. It was comforting to be in the presence of someone who had known him. There were so few people left. Lookstein and my father had been part of the same circle during all those years before he met my mother. When I had written my piece for The New Yorker about my father's ill-fated marriage to Dorothy, I had interviewed Lookstein's sister, who had been married to my dad's best friend. That tight-knit group of young people in post-war Manhattan seemed to have lived contented lives shaped by ritual and faith. But my father had been unlucky within all that simple contentment. Divorced, then widowed. The great Lubavitcher Rebbe Menachem Schneerson himself had counseled my father to postpone the wedding until Dorothy died, but he couldn't bring himself to hurt her. Instead, he moved forward with an indelible action that carried with it agonizing consequences. He took a short, harsh journey on behalf of the woman he loved. Lookstein nodded and tipped his hat as we parted on the corner of 84th and Park. Was it my imagination, or were his eyes brimming with tears? We thought your father was a hero, he said. Chapter 26. I returned again and again with renewed astonishment to the 36 hours that had elapsed from the moment I discovered my father wasn't my biological father until the moment Ben Walden appeared on my computer screen. 36 hours. Like a video I saw of an Australian kid solving a Rubik's Cube in 7.36 seconds. Impossible, but not. I would never be tempted to get a tattoo of my donor's number. I would never order a parent on a chain dog tag necklace. I was lucky. Ben was alive, healthy, not very old. and at least for the moment, he was willing to engage with me. But what, exactly, did I want from him? Ben Walden was not the deepest part of the story for me. He was not the end of the mystery, but rather the beginning. My visit with Rabbi Lookstein had not eased my heart. In fact, it had confused me further. I rewrote my own history repeatedly until the contents of my mind resembled a chalkboard, words not entirely erased, all smudged a cloudy white. Had my mother lied? Had the doctor covered it up? Why else would my father have raced to Philadelphia? But then there was Lookstein. Kol HaKavod. Everywhere I looked, there seemed another possible set of circumstances. And each set of circumstances painted my past in a different light. I dove into the books and printouts of articles from old magazines and scholarly journals that were stacked on my office floor, my bedside table, the kitchen counter. Lethal Secrets, Artificial Insemination, Personhood Revisited, in an attempt to understand the culture that my parents inhabited. In 1961, Edward Albee's eviscerating play about a childless couple, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, was about to open on Broadway. A Newsweek survey revealed that 0% of Americans considered no children the ideal family size. What state of desperation would my parents have found themselves in? And what actions might have arisen from that desperation? A 2010 paper titled, My Daddy's Name is Donor, painted a vivid picture. Donor conception has always been shrouded in secrecy. Anonymity is the thick cloth that permits no one to look inside. For years, the medical profession has touted anonymity as the answer to the quandaries created by sperm and egg donation. Anonymity protects the donor from having to confront the inconvenient truth that a child might be born from his or her own body. It protects parents who do not wish for an outside party to intrude on their family and who quite often choose not to tell their children. And it certainly facilitates the buying and selling of sperm and eggs as products, no longer identified with one wholly unique human being whose life continues to evolve long after the donation is made. As a director of one of the oldest sperm banks in the U.S. said, without anonymity, you're going to lose the really smart, the really wonderful people who I think are going to question, do I really want to be in a situation where, down the road, someone may contact me? Ben's communication with me was careful. I had the sense that each email had been combed over by multiple people, his wife, perhaps his children. One of his sons was an attorney. I had never before been in the role of being someone's worst nightmare, but I was pretty sure that this was the case now. Ben was a good man, an ethical man. He could have blown me off, ghosted me. Thus far he had been responsive, but surely he wasn't happy about the biological child who had appeared out of nowhere to disrupt his life. Back in San Francisco, I had told Michael that if I had confirmation that Ben was my biological father, along with important medical history, I would be okay. It was more than most people got. I had seen his face. I had been able to watch him in motion, to see his gestures, his smile. I knew where I came from. It would be enough. So when, early one morning, I opened an email from Ben containing just what I had hoped for, information about a rare hereditary eye condition he had discovered in his early 70s, along with assurances that there had been no cancer, heart disease, or Alzheimer's in his family, I should have felt relieved. But there was something else, something I couldn't quite put my finger on. Ben had written that he'd decided not to take a DNA test because he didn't trust the privacy provisions on commercial testing sites. He told me that he had been discussing the whole situation with his wife and children, that his family wished privacy in this matter. Situation, matter, and again, privacy. The words disturbed me, but beneath the disturbance was something I wasn't used to feeling. I walked through my days feeling weighed down by a peculiar, polarizing heaviness. I wanted to hide. It was shame, I realized. The Walden family wished privacy in the matter of me. What more did I want? After all, I had been given the very information I thought would make me whole. Above all, I wanted to eradicate this terrible shame, this sense of being defective, alien, other, as if perhaps I never should have existed at all. It was why I now realized I had included my website in my original email to Ben. It wasn't only so that he could see that my motives weren't mercenary. See, I wanted to say, I am a real person with a full, rich life and a family of my own. I wasn't just the product of some random morning in Philadelphia, possibly one among many such mornings, during which he masturbated into a cup, tucked his shirt back into his pants, pocketed a few dollars, and returned to anatomy class. I understood that he didn't want to think about something so unseemly. He was a successful, erudite, grandfatherly gentleman. I also realized that he had become a donor under the cloak of secrecy, the thick veil of anonymity that had been pervasive at the time. In 1961, it had been only 9 years since Watson and Crick had discovered DNA. The thought of a future in which it would be possible to spit into a plastic vial and discover one's genetic heritage would have been the stuff of science fiction. But here I was, an inconvenient truth that had indeed been born from his own body, a consequence of his actions, a wholly unique human being whose life continued to evolve long after his donation was made. My very existence was due to the fact that he never dreamt he'd have to deal with such a thing. And what I wished for now, though I knew expressing it might topple our entire parsed, careful dialogue, was to meet him, to be in the presence, just once, of this man I came from. "Be careful," Wendy Kramer had cautioned. "He's a doctor. He's used to being in control. Keep your foot in the door. Let him call the shots." I waited until midsummer before writing Ben Walden with my request. I told him I'd fly to Portland for a cup of coffee, that I'd do whatever would make him feel most comfortable. I imagined sitting across from him at a cafe, Portland was a city full of cafes, and looking into his eyes so like my own. I had watched his YouTube video perhaps a dozen times, each time struck anew by the similarities between us. I wanted nothing from him beyond this. I reassured him that I would continue to be respectful of his privacy. I hoped he would give this one-time meeting serious consideration. It would go a long way toward making the surreal real. To Danny Shapiro, from Dr. Benjamin Walden, Ray, 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 important letter. "Dear Danny, thanks for your very thoughtful note. I'm still trying to get my head around the fact that I have a biological daughter unknown to me for 54 years. At the moment, my life is very busy, and I'm still processing your request. It will take me some time to respond thoughtfully. So I'll write back in a few weeks to let you know my thinking, as filtered through my family input. All the best, Ben." Chapter 27. It was time to tell Jacob. He had just returned from his summer program and was settling back into life at home. I hadn't wanted to give him this strange news while he was still in California, in case it would be upsetting to him. But I couldn't withhold it any longer. I had raised him without secrets, perhaps to a fault. I had grown up in a house where the air crackled with the unsaid. I had always wished for Jacob to feel that in his home, the air was clear. As I considered how and when to tell Jacob, I wondered, as I had when we were with him in L.A., whether it would matter. What were genes, after all, to a 17-year-old boy? Michael had been focused on the idea that Jacob now had a different grandfather, a living grandfather. But would Jacob feel that Ben Walden was his grandfather? I doubted it. Jacob had never known my dad, so would this feel like a loss to him? I thought about this as I cooked my son's favorite dinner, grilled steak, roasted broccoli, spaghetti with butter, and grated Parmesan, as if a good meal might help. Family dinner had been a cornerstone of our lives since Jacob was in his high chair. So much of my way of doing things had been a reaction to the choices my parents had made. I had always known that I formed myself in opposition to my mother. but I hadn't realized to what degree I had designed our family life counter to the one I remembered. As a child, I had most often eaten dinner alone. Meals with my parents were always in the dining room. The house of my childhood was formal and cold. The home I had shared with Michael and Jacob for 15 years was simple and warm. But more than anything, what I aimed for was ease. I wanted to laugh with my son. I wanted him to feel he could be honest with me. And just about nothing made me happier than seeing how close he was with his dad. They had a few passions in common, particularly music and the Red Sox, and a dialogue that was all theirs. Michael had a good-sized family. His parents were still living and had always been a big part of Jacob's life. Jacob had uncles, aunts, and an assortment of cousins as well. It had been a source of sadness to me that I hadn't been able to give him the same. No grandparents, a half-aunt who displayed little interest, and cousins who were Black Hat Orthodox, with whom he shared nothing at all. I had made sure to encourage a relationship between Jacob and my father's younger sister, Shirley, who was unusually open-minded despite her strict religious beliefs. The previous year, we had gone to Chicago for a visit, but the threads connecting him to my family were few and fraying. I thought back to Jacob's bar mitzvah. I had presented him with a blue velvet pouch containing my father's enormous yellowed talis, the same one I remembered playing with as a child in shul. It had dwarfed him, and my Aunt Shirley had sent along a pair of silver filigreed talis clips to hold it together on his narrow frame. "Here's my father's talis. You wrap it around yourself like this. These clips were your great-grandfather's." I had felt on that day nearly 5 years earlier a sense of completion. My boy, enfolded in his grandfather's prayer shawl. A modern, eclectic service that I had worked hard to design, which reflected our family and also honored my dad and his legacy. Though my Orthodox relatives would not attend Jacob's bar mitzvah, I felt I had their blessing. I stood next to Jacob in front of our gathered family and friends and spoke of how proud his grandfather would have been of him. L'dor v'dor. "Honey, there's something important we need to talk with you about." Jacob was suddenly very focused as we sat down to dinner. "Nothing's wrong," I added quickly. "You don't need to worry." As I began to share the story with Jacob, it felt unlike any previous time I had recounted it. It mattered. Whether he would be aware of it or not, it mattered to him. I was giving him a missing piece of his own history. Michael was across the table from me, quiet, listening, as I went through the details. The DNA test, the strange results, the lack of a biological connection to Susie, the mysterious first cousin, the artificial insemination, the discovery of the young medical student from the University of Pennsylvania. My voice shook. I was trying not to cry. Telling Jacob that my father wasn't his grandfather felt like I was undoing the work of a lifetime, or perhaps several lifetimes. Jacob reached over and took my hand once he understood. "Are you okay, Mom?" His chair scraped back as he stood and came around the table to hug me, my beautiful boy, who wouldn't exist if everything hadn't happened just as it did. The dogs hunted for scraps at our feet. As I held Jacob close, I kept reminding myself that everything I had built, my family, my personhood, was unaltered. My new knowledge changed both everything and nothing. My life was like one of those large and complicated jigsaw puzzles that once finished displayed a completely different image on the reverse side. A streetcar in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge. Van Gogh's sunflowers, a self-portrait. Same puzzle pieces, same materials, same shape. Different picture. As it slowly sank in, Jacob asked only a few questions, all of them about Ben. "Is he alive?" "Yes." I hadn't told Jacob Ben's name. I didn't want him going upstairs to his room and heading down the Google rabbit hole. I also wanted to protect my son. I had no idea how Ben was ultimately going to respond to my request for that single cup of coffee. He gave a nod. "Are you going to meet him?" "I don't know," I'd like to. I hope so. Can I meet him? Let's see what happens. I resisted the ridiculous urge to tell Jacob that his grandfather was still his grandfather. What could that possibly mean to him? My father was an abstraction, an ancestor to him, nothing more. All those stories, the Tallis, the sepia photographs scattered around our house of the little boy in the bowler hat, those were important to me. But they held no more of a sense of reality for my son than the fables and fairy tales I'd read to him when he was a child. Jacob sat back down at the table and began cutting up his steak. I was suddenly hungry myself, relieved that this conversation which had been looming was now behind us. I watched as he ate his dinner with the gusto of a teenager and wondered if he would always remember this evening or if it would eventually fall into the category of weird but no big deal. He seemed to be lost in thought as he ran a hand through his thick, dark blonde hair. I waited to see if there was anything else he wanted to know, or if we were just going to move on to other subjects. The Red Sox had a game that night. He and Michael would probably watch after dinner. He took a big sip of water, started to say something, then stopped. What? You know you can ask me anything. His hand raked through his hair again. So, just wondering, does this mean maybe I won't end up bald? Michael and I burst out laughing. My father and grandfather had heads like cue balls. I hadn't known it had even occurred to Jacob that it was hereditary. Ben Walden, on the other hand, did indeed have an excellent head of hair. You probably won't end up bald, honey, I said, glad that he was able to crack a joke. I hadn't considered that particular upside. Chapter 28. That very first night, as Michael sat in our kitchen searching for the words Institute and Philadelphia, it had quickly become clear that my parents had had excellent options closer to home. Cornell's medical school was at that time still housed at New York Hospital. The Margaret Sanger Clinic was well known. And just an hour and a half north in New Haven, Yale School of Medicine's Department of Reproductive Endocrinology would have been considered the gold standard. My mother prided herself on always choosing the best of the best, whether in clothing, furniture, art, or jewelry. When she was dying, she felt compelled to tell me that the Armani jacket in her closet still had its tags on, and that the double string of pearls was particularly fine. And she had mentioned more than once that her Park Avenue obstetrician's office was lined with photographs of movie stars, signed with notes of thanks. She enjoyed thinking of herself in the company of Ava Gardner and Rita Hayworth. So how had my parents ended up at the Farris Institute for Parenthood? Was there something about Farris that was different from the others? Or perhaps my parents wanted to go further afield to avoid any chance of running into someone they knew? My mother had taken pains to describe Edmund Farris as a world-famous doctor, a pioneer in his field. If this was the case, there was surprisingly little information available about his work. Michael and I had been able to ascertain that he'd begun his career at the Wistar Institute, a scientific research center housed at Penn, and had risen to the position of director. But in the mid-1950s, Farris had been summarily dismissed. It was at that point that a few small newspaper articles about his new institute began to appear. Not the stuff of world fame. I finally came across a video interview of Leonard Hayflick, an elderly endocrinologist who had worked at Wistar, in which he mentioned Farris. Hayflick was 88, and I could find no email for him, only a phone number. He answered the phone with a sharp, "Yes?" in lieu of a hello. "Is this Leonard Hayflick? Who wants to know?" I wasn't cut out for this kind of reporting. I stuttered out my name and reasons for calling him until he became convinced I wasn't a telemarketer. Once we were clear on why we were speaking, I asked him if he could give me background on Edmund Farris. "I knew Farris at Wistar," Hayflick told me. "A strange little man. When did you say you were born?" 1962. "Impossible," he said. His lab at Wistar no longer existed by then. He had been kicked out in the mid-1950s. He was performing artificial inseminations, and the church found out. There was press. The local bishops became involved. Pressure built. And then he opened his own institute, I told him, the Farris Institute for Parenthood, where I was conceived. Hayflick had never heard of the institute, and he had trouble believing that Farris had continued to operate near the campus of Penn after his dismissal from Wistar. But about this much, I was certain. I was proof of it. I began to think that Hayflick wasn't going to be of much help to me beyond a sense that Farris was unpopular, a renegade. Hayflick described him as a Napoleonic type, short but dynamic, with sharp elbows, someone who had made a lot of enemies. But then, Hayflick began talking about the science, his area of expertise. It seemed that Farris was a pioneer in two divergent ways, both of which would turn out to have been of great importance to my parents. First, he had developed a method by which a woman's ovulation could be monitored. Wistar was world famous for its colony of albino, virgin, female rats, Hayflick said. Just when I thought the story couldn't possibly get weirder. For months after this conversation, white rats would populate my dreams. While Farris was at Wistar, he benefited from the rat colony at no cost to him. The morning urine specimens of women would be inoculated into the ovaries of the rats, and then, a couple of days later, the animals would be sacrificed so that the ovaries could be examined. If the veins were red and swelling, it would show the hormonal surge of the woman's ovulation. But there was a second area in which Farris had broken new ground, according to Hayflick, who clearly hadn't liked him and was loath to credit him with any discovery. Farris was among the first, if not the first, in the field of reproductive medicine to consider the male as the possible reason for a couple's infertility. Sexism was profound, Hayflick said, and it was always assumed that it was the wife, not the husband, who was responsible for the infertility problem. But Farris looked at sperm specimens for low motility and poor morphology. My parents. My mother, pushing 40. Trying, month after month, year after year, desperate to have a baby. When had her miscarriages occurred? Before or during their excursions to Philadelphia? And why had she miscarried, over and over again? The culture dictated that the problem lay with her. Plus, my father already had a child. So when they chose the Farris Institute for Parenthood, it would have likely been because of Farris's innovation. Perhaps my mother's Park Avenue obstetrician to the stars pressed a phone number into her palm. Go see this doctor. I've heard he gets good results. My mother's urine injected into the ovaries of albino, virgin rats. But at some point, perhaps even at their very first appointment, Farris would have evaluated my father's sperm as a matter of course. He had been writing academic papers about male infertility that had been infuriating the medical establishment since the 1940s. He would have looked through his microscope at a slide and determined just how unlikely it would be for this couple to have their own child. An older mother, a sub-fertile father, a couple who could not fathom their future without a baby, without their baby. A scientist with sharp elbows and a Napoleon complex. An era in which doctors played God. In which religious leaders of every faith decreed donor insemination an abomination, in which, in legal terms, it was often considered adultery and the child a bastard. What course was invisibly charted for my parents after they crossed the threshold of that institute in Philadelphia? Did my father race in vain, believing he was doing everything possible to have his own child? I imagine him now, as he leaves his job and takes the subway to Penn Station. He settles himself on the train to Philly and cracks open the Wall Street Journal. But he is distracted. His mind drifts to my mother, his bewildering, despairing wife. He must feel it is his fault. Slow sperm. So unlucky. Divorced, widowed. Now this. He has told no one. He bears the journey toward making a family alone. In a small room next to a laboratory where white rats are locked in their cages, My mother waits. She is capable of being very still, my mother, like a statue, with her hands clasped, her legs crossed, a small smile in place. She's gonna have a baby, goddammit. And this much is certain. At some point, a fair-haired, blue-eyed medical student is also present. Pains are taken to be sure that Ben Walden and my mother never cross paths, though he is probably no more than 50 feet away, in another room discreetly outfitted with old issues of Playboy. His sperm has to be fresh. Time is of the essence. If his sperm is indeed to be mixed with my father's, whether my father is aware of it or not, the two men might even pass each other in the halls of the Farris Institute. Dr. Edmund Farris knew the score, but did he explain it clearly to my mother and father? Did he tell them that their chances of having their own baby were next to nil? That there was good news, a ready solution, one that might be difficult to contemplate, but would greatly increase their chances for success. The more I continued to learn, the less I trusted any story. When I was growing up in suburban New Jersey, in a neighborhood of pretty homes built on well-tended one-acre lots, two cars in the driveway, and families of three, four, even five kids, it was notable that I was an only child, especially because my parents were older. I now wonder what people thought of the white blonde, pale girl who lived in the red brick house on the corner. When people commented on the size of our family, which, amazingly, they did, my mother had a ready response. I can hear her voice as if she's here in the room as I write these words. She would turn her beautiful, darting eyes on me, and I would feel pride. "I may only have one, but I hit the jackpot," she would say. As if it were a lottery. She had won me. I was her prize. Chapter 29. Until I was in my mid-30s, I met Michael at 34 and Jacob was born days after I turned 37. My inner world was defined and shaped by longing. This longing was vast, wide, and I was not able to put words to it. All I knew was what I felt, which was a constant interior ache that propelled me. At times I felt like a sleepwalker in my own life, moving to a strange choreography whose steps I knew by heart. I have now read interview after interview with donor-conceived people, particularly those whose origins were not disclosed to them, who describe this longing, this sense of being trapped on the other side of an invisible wall, separate, alone, cut off, and worst of all, not knowing why. During my childhood, this ache took on two forms. First, I snooped. Whenever my parents were out of the house, as my bored babysitter watched television or talked on the phone with her boyfriend, I would stealthily climb the stairs to my parents' bedroom and open their drawers and closets. Many children are curious about their parents' private lives, but my ritual bordered on obsession. I ran my fingertips over my mother's chiffon scarves, folded delicately in tissue. Her scent, rather a mélange of scents, wafted up from inside each drawer. Gardenia, jasmine, orchid, sandalwood, oak moss, vetiver. Beneath her bathroom sink, she stored dozens of unopened boxes of L'Air du Temps and Caleche, as if she was afraid of ever running out. Her jewelry drawer was locked, but I had located the key and explored her necklaces, bracelets, earrings, and pins whenever I could, as if clues to who my mother really was might be found amid the gems. My parents slept, according to Orthodox tradition, in single beds that were pushed together and attached to one headboard, but made separately, each with its own set of sheets and blankets. The religious reason for this had to do with the belief that a woman is unclean during her menstrual cycle, and the couple shouldn't touch at all during this time. I would sit on the sea of my parents' two beds and look around their room. The heavy silk curtains, their bedside tables with their twin clocks, the needlepoint pillows with their tiny stitches, all seemed to hold some sort of elusive truth. Then, If I still had time, I would walk into each of their offices and rifle through the papers covering their desks, careful to leave no trace. It wasn't anything specific I was after. It was just a sense that something was out of reach, and if I could only find it, this terrible feeling of longing would go away. I'd have my answer to a question I couldn't even formulate. My second response to the constant ache was to look for a new family. I didn't realize that this was what I was doing, of course. We had a small dog, a poodle, and I walked that dog around our neighborhood every chance I got. I took the same route each afternoon and longer walks on weekends. The neighborhood streets were named after English locales: Exeter Way, Surrey Court, Westminster Avenue. But it was the identity of each family in each home that consumed me. The Quenzels had four kids, the youngest of whom was my age. The dad was a dentist. The Markowitzes were also a family of six. The dad was a builder and the mom was young. The mothers were all a lot younger than mine, I came to realize. The Wilfs, Panterers, and Kushners were among the community of Holocaust survivors. The Topolos had three mostly grown children. The dad was an ophthalmologist. The boys were already in college. Lawns were littered with swings, jungle gyms, plastic recliners. Sprinklers sprayed gentle arcs back and forth. I knew the neighbors' cars and made a study of the patterns of their comings and goings. Once school let out each day, it seemed like the moms and kids gathered at home. The dads pulled into the driveways at dusk. As I lurked and watched, I was like an anthropologist studying a foreign culture. Another form of life was going on behind the closed doors of these homes, a different, easier, more comfortable life than what was happening in mine. As a grown woman, a mother myself, I received a phone call one day from our across-the-street neighbor from long ago. She felt compelled to share a memory about my childhood. I took notes as I listened. Alarm went off. Babysitter in the basement didn't hear. You came running across the street, scared, alone. As she recounted the story, I remembered the loud clanging, my confusion.